Welcome to the Libertarian Institute YouTube and Odyssey channel. Today I am joined by my colleague at the Libertarian Institute, Sheldon Richman, to discuss some articles we have come across and interviews we've come across in the last week or so. Sheldon, first up, we have the use of knowledge in society. What can we learn from this one?
Well, this is an oldie but goodie. Some people may know that. This is a Hayek. This is like one of the classic Hayek papers that he published in the American Economic Review. American Economic Review in 1945. So I'm not just learning about it, but a lot of people may not know about it, especially younger people. So I wanted to bring their attention to it because it's so important. And I wrote about it last week or the week before, wrote about it recently. So you can look up a summary if you don't want to go through the paper. Although, you know, while it's a bit dry, it's easy to understand. Hayek's point in this is very important. By the way, it's reprinted in his collection, Individualism and Economic Order, which is a very nice collection that's available in paperback. You can find it at Amazon. And I think you can find maybe all the chapters even online if you Google. What Hayek argues here is that when you think about it, society faces what looks like an insoluble problem, if you're thinking about it kind of in the abstract. And the problem is this: we certainly want to see society in a way organized. And by that, I don't mean by, you know, a small committee of people or one person, but I mean, we would like a society that if it's going to be serving the individual welfare of everyone, the problem is the knowledge and information that would be necessary for a society to actually be serving individuals in their attempts to become, you know, more prosperous and be able to live the lives they want to live, a modern great society, let's say industrial society. The problem is that knowledge is scattered throughout, you know, millions and millions of people. In our society, we get, you know, over 300 million, 8 billion in the world, but everybody's got a bit of important knowledge if the idea is the welfare of, you know, the individual citizens, the individual people. We're not trying to please the rulers. We want a society that serves the flourishing of the members of it. So how do we get a hold of this information, Hayek was asking in 45. And don't forget, this is right after World War II, when planning was all the rage, because there was planning during the war, certainly World War II, rationing and everything. And a lot of statists thought, well, if it works so great during war, why not have it during peacetime? Well, Hayek was saying there's too much information that's scattered, that's incomplete, that's yet to be discovered, and that's not even articulated. It's what, you know, we call tacit knowledge of how, not knowledge of that, but knowing how, not knowing that, but knowing how to do something. Like, take an easy example, riding a bike. It's very hard to describe to someone how to ride a bike, but you can ride a bike, but you probably have a very tough time explaining it. So his answer to that is there is an answer. The answer is the price system. The price system are little bits of relevant knowledge which are the result of people buying and selling in the market or abstaining from buying and selling in the market, expressing their preferences on the spot as they face alternatives. That gets filtered into prices, and prices inform entrepreneurs and others about relative scarcities, et cetera. There's no alternative to it. All the schemes that have been cooked up, like, you know, computer market socialism or big computer can figure it all out, all that has to fail because none of them can even touch what the real price system does. But to have the price system and honest real prices, you have to have self-regulating markets, not government influencing the market.
My first one this week is from a book titled Economy, Society, and History, where there is a section where Dr. Hans Hoppe says, first, we should recognize that institutions such as states show a natural aggressiveness. The explanation is very simple. If you have to fund your own aggressive ventures yourself out of your own pocket, that will curtail some of your natural inclination to fight other people because you have to pay for it yourself. On the other hand, if you imagine that if I want to fight some of you guys and I could tax him, him or him and ask them to support me in fighting endeavors, then whatever my initial aggressive impulses might be are certainly stimulated because I can externalize the cost of war onto other people. I don't have to bear the cost myself. Other people have to bear the cost. This explains why institutions that have the power to tax, and also institutions that have the power to print money in later ages, have financial abilities that make it more likely that we go to war than you would go to war if the power to tax was lacking or the power to print money was lacking on your part. The reason this is so important is because anytime that we advocate voluntary exchanges between consenting adults, it's like, well, what if there's a really bad result? And if there is a bad result, then you people have to answer for it. You're advocating this policy. If people use that freedom to do bad things, you now have to bear the cost. And this is now a stain on your reputation, both intellectually and your spiritual reputation, whatever they're going to say. Seldom do they realize, you know, as much as I like to advocate things like government helping the poor or whatnot, this same organization that I advocate have all this money and all this power is responsible for some of the greatest atrocities that the human race has experienced. So it's so vitally important to recognize that the state is the health of war. Sheldon, what is the hoax of the century?
Well, this is a very interesting article by a man by the name of Jacob Siegel, writing in an online, I think it's only online, I don't know if there's a paper version, called Tablet. And it is about how, the subtitle is 13 Ways of Looking at Disinformation. And he's also been interviewed, so it's kind of a long article. It's easy to read, but it is long, there are plenty of details. He's also been interviewed by Reason's Nick Gillespie and also Glenn Greenwald. So you could look that up if you want to just hear him talk about it. But he is documenting how in 13 different ways, the term disinformation was sort of invented and then used by the government to control opinion in the United States. And we're already all familiar with this. We know about the Twitter files and how the intelligence agencies and Homeland Security and the FBI leaned on and met constantly with Twitter, but also the other social networks to put a lid on information they did not like, that they found inconvenient, even if it were true, about all kinds of things. Much of it is about Russia, but there was also COVID and various other issues. It's still going on now. It began originally to squelch what they thought was disinformation, and may well have been, just propaganda by jihadists during the Islamic State at that time. There were people online trying to win over Americans and other Muslims to their team, and so it might have started as an effort to counter some of that. But then it got carried over. They liked these methods so much they thought, well, we can certainly use this to shape American opinion where we feel that's necessary. So they did it with the Hunter Biden laptop. They did it earlier with RussiaGate. To refresh people's memory, the intelligence agencies told Twitter and others that there's a Soviet or Russia propaganda coming down the pike just before the 2020 election, even though they knew that the Hunter Biden laptop was not a Russian trick. And so he documents in all these ways. I mean, it's really kind of overwhelming. It's a bit despairing. The way the government has used this new quote pseudoscience of disinformation, the hunting out of disinformation as a way to, manufacture consent, to use a title of a book Noam Chomsky and I think Edward Herman wrote many years ago, that the government is capable of manufacturing consent. And it has done this using the new technology. So it's certainly worth reading. It's certainly worth looking up the interviews. The author's name is Jacob Siegel, So I would take a look for that.
My next one is a section from Voters as Mad Scientists, Essays on Political Irrationality by Brian Kaplan. On page 112, he talks about how it's amazing the politicians are usually very pessimistic and things are terrible. And one of the things they say is that in the voluntary sector, what happens is you have to pay for things and everyone's always trying to get one over on you. And it's dog eat dog competition. They, of course, never apply that to the Democratic sphere, where politicians are constantly lying, giving false advertising, always in competition with who gets to be president, who gets to be senator of that state. But what Kaplan is focusing on page 112, is the concept of free, where people say that if you want stuff free, the state has the ability to make it so. Of course, this doesn't account for the fact that people are initially taxed to pay for these things, and resources that are used for whatever is, quote, free are resources that are diverted from other things. So free is just a myth. But he talks about what is the closest we have to free or really cheap. Kaplan says, Amazon is simply the best store that ever existed by far, with incredible selection and unearthly convenience. The price? Cheap. Facebook, Twitter, and other social media let us socialize with our friends comfortably, meet new people, and explore even the most obscure interests. The price? Free. Uber and Lyft provide high-quality, convenient transportation. The price? Really cheap. Skype is a sci-fi quality video phone. The price? Free. YouTube gives us endless entertainment. The price? Free. Google gives us the totality of human knowledge. The price? Free. I also would have added Wikipedia in that section. But it just goes to show you that even when people are able to live through something and experience it, they can be extraordinarily ungrateful. And it's through the voluntary sector where we get these great innovations in both quality and cost. Sheldon, what is this interview with Glenn Dyson?
Yes, I apparently pronounce it Glenn Dyson. This is an interview that Thaddeus Russell did with him on his regular YouTube, I guess he also has a podcast, Unregistered, it's called. Dyson is the author of a book, I think it came out last year, called Russophobia. This relates to my last item, too. And Dyson is an academic in Norway, I believe the Southeast Norway University. He's a Russia expert, and he's written a book, which I've read a bit of, but also have heard the interview with him, about this idea of Russophobia, which also is a very major discussion of what is propaganda. And he wants to point out, and in no way is he an advocate for Russian conduct or Putin. He's no fan of Putin. He has no wish to be a defender of Russia. But he wants to say that what matters today is not facts about Russia. I mean, even when they're doing a bad thing, the Russian government's doing a bad thing to somebody. But the point is that for a very long time, this goes back actually a couple centuries, there has been this demonization of Russia, even pre-Soviet, going back, he says, to Peter the Great in the 17th and 18th century in Europe, because Russia was always the subject of demonization. It was regarded as sort of a Asian intruder in Asia, Europe, and that this has carried over into our time. It certainly was true during the existence of the Soviet Union. We had the Red Scare, and then we had McCarthyism and all that. But even with the fall of the Soviet Union and the Russian Federation surviving, the demonization has occurred. And this what this means is, by propaganda, he means appealing to people's emotions and fears, and not to reason. So in other words, it's one thing to say the Russian government has done something bad here. Here are the facts. All you need to say is Russia is probably behind it or is behind it. And we've seen this over and over again with the Hunter Biden laptop, right, with the former and current intelligence people said, you know, this has all the signs of being Russian disinformation, even though they had the laptop for months and knew it wasn't. But the media picked it up and even dropped the idea that there were just signs of Russian disinformation. They just claimed it was Russian disinformation because we know that sort of Russia, it's almost like a form of racism, really. Russia are congenital liars, as one intelligence or former intelligence person basically put it. You know, he said they were virtually congenital liars. And so all you need to do is say it's Russia, and you don't have to prove anything after that. So this is a book-length study of that, and his interview with Thaddeus Russell, who's the author. Russell is the author of A Renegade History of America or the United States, which is an interesting book too, goes through this in detail. And he talks about, you know, all the things we've been living through over the last 10 years or more, you know, including Ukraine. Now, it's one thing to say, and he doesn't want to defend, he doesn't defend Putin or Russia in invading Ukraine, but the idea is, you know, under the demonization model, you can't even mention like NATO, the expansion of NATO by American leaders since Bill Clinton, without being called a Putin, agent. That's demonization. It's one thing to debate that question, and, you know, we can condemn Russia and Putin for invading and killing non-combatants in Ukraine. I've done that. We can do that. But also we can discuss whether NATO made Russia the least bit concerned about its security, or actually seriously concerned. No, under demonization, under Russophobia, those things can't even be discussed. If it's Russia, it's bad. And so it's worth hearing the interview. It's worth, you know, taking a look at the book, perhaps. If you have a Kindle, you can read the beginning of it. It's an expensive book, unfortunately. But this guy, I think, is onto something. And I stress, you know, he's no Russian apologist. He's just calling for a dispassionate, factual look at what Russia's doing and not demonizing a whole group of people.
My final one is from a book published by the School of Life called Philosophy in 40 Ideas. They have some of the most efficient books. They almost rival the Libertarian Institute with how good their books are. But just one sentence from page 13, a democratic vote is like the captain of a ship having to consult every passenger about the best course to chart through an approaching storm. You can ask yourself, how much better would Adele's music be if we all got to vote, if we all had the privilege and the right to vote on how she would sing her songs, or if everyone was involved in constructing Seinfeld and how the episodes were operated, or if we were all consulted on how stoves or printers or computers or houses should be built? Things would be a lot worse if a bunch of people who were completely ignorant with regard to the topic at hand had much more institutional power. That is one of the many reasons why when NATO advocates say we are fighting for democracy, it's not democracy that is important. It is the free association which makes society possible. Thank you to everyone for watching the Libertarian Institute YouTube and Odyssey channel, along with everyone listening to the podcast version. Sheldon, thank you for your time.
Pleasure.